last.
You know, transitioning from one committee to the other is getting challenging, but we're going to do our best to make sure we start on time. Carlson, you're first in the agenda, Senate File 1446, and we are ready for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I've had a little... don't have any amendments or anything, right? Or
no,
do you?
I do not.
No, okay.
What I have is a shortage of testifiers, but I think we can go ahead.
In my agenda, I only have one testifier. Do you have him? Is he present?
Thank you.
No, he is not. But
Senator, would you like me to wait and we could wait and just proceed with Senator Stumpf while you wait for your testifier, or would you like to go on your own?
Actually, Madam Chair, I think I'd like to go ahead because we're talking about an extraordinarily simple bill.
Okay. That makes sense.
I like those.
Madam Chair, I'm bringing Senate File 1446 to you, which simply changes the date for a Hire the Veteran Month from May to July. And the reason is that it'll coincide with a major veterans job fair. The Minnesota Department of Veterans and DEED administer a major job fair for veterans in July of each year, and by altering the Hire the Veteran Month, it'll help bring more awareness to the event. The bill was briefly heard in the other body and is not controversial. I have no opposition.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, I believe this is a simple bill, and I don't know if there's anybody in the audience who is opposed to this or who wishes to testify. And I believe we do have quorum, right? Senator Johnson is here. Yeah, we're here. We have quorum. So Senator Eaton moves Senate File 1446 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Correct? Yes. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks.
Aye.
Stumpf is here.
Senator Stumpf is here. Senate File 1225. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jeez, she don't mess around.
It is my understanding, Madam Chair, that we have an agreement that would delete the section that would that has caused it to come here, which is the advisory.
Okay.
Which is on line or page 2. It's the steering committee. And I believe the amendment is the A3 amendment, which would take that out.
Thank you. Yes, we have the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment is in your packets, members. Are you clear on that? So the senator will delete the language that brought that bill to our attention to begin with. So does anybody have a comment, a question for the senator? Senator, I believe you have someone who is ready to answer questions just in case, or do you wish to testify?
No, I'm okay. Just if needed.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the author's amendment.
Okay. Senator Peterson moves the A3 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And then I believe that the bill would be ready to move out.
Yes, it is. We always want to talk about the content of these bills, but it's not our jurisdiction, unfortunately. So we will have a chance to see it in the floor. So, Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 1225 be recommended to pass and re-refer to, where does it go? Finance. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Senate File, is Senator Marty here?
Yes.
He's on his way. Do we have Senator Sachs out here? Senator Miller?
Yeah, Miller was just here.
Senator Miller. Thank you for being here, Senator Miller. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We have Senate File 417.
Yes, so Senate File 417. Madam Chair and members, I do have a letter that we just got from Houston County, if you guys want to pass this out. It's a very straightforward bill. Houston County has requested that we change the amount of years that members of the Economic Development Authority have to serve specifically for their county. And what you'll see from the letter, Madam Chair and members, is Houston County has a very difficult time getting community members to commit to a six-year term. So they are asking us.
Senator Miller, if my sincere apology, it seems like they have printed Senate File 417, and we were supposed to have House File 417.
Oh, sure.
So this is Senator Dahl's bill. If you could give us a second, we do need to have Senator Miller's. This is the wrong bill.
Yeah. It says here, though.
It's the correct number, but Senator Miller has House File 417.
Right.
This is Senate File.
So.
Yes, 408. Our Senate file is 408.
Table
so it's incorrectly. We apologize, Senator. We have to correct that. We have to amend the agenda.
Okay.
To make sure that we have. Oh, no, the agenda is correct because it says House File. It's just that we made a mistake in terms of printing the incorrect bill. They just pulled out Senate File 417, so there was a. If you could give us a moment.
No problem, Madam Chair. As long as I don't have to leave, I'm fine.
No. The agenda has the correct. So I don't have to amend the agenda or anything. It's just that they printed the incorrect bill.
Madam Chair,
yes,
how long
Senator
will it take to have them printed? If it takes much. Why don't we just go on to Sachs-Hawks?
Yeah. Yes, that's
table
a good
this?
Suggestion, Senator. So we're going to table this, Senator, and we'll bring you back because we do
no
have
problem.
To have the correct
thank you.
Bill printed for the members so they can read it. And in the meantime, we have Senator Sachs-Hawk, Senate File 1455. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You have Senate
Members.
File 1455.
Yes, Madam Chair. We're presenting Senate File 1455. This bill repeals the statute that authorizes a district court to appoint the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs as guardian of the estate of a veteran or dependent when the court finds appointment of a guardian to be necessary. With me today is Mike McKelney, Legislative Director, and Brad Lindsay, Acting Deputy Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they're going to give brief presentations and help answer any questions.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. As Senator Sachs-Hawk has pointed out, this is... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Mike McKelney, Legislative Director for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. This bill, all it does is it repeals and pulls out of statute a program that we used to do that started in 1976. Initially, it was an unfunded a program that eventually we found some money for, and we held that program or conducted that program up until the early 2000s when some federal policy changed, which made it no longer necessary for the department to continue to do that. What it did is the commissioner provided a fiduciary for incapacitated veterans. So initially, it had several members that we took care of. But again, when the federal policy changed, I think it was around 2002, the agency kind of saw the writing on the wall and started to winnow that program. So we had our last veterans that we took care of in 2006, I believe, and stopped doing that service in 2007.
Members, do you have any questions for the senator or the justifier, Senator Eaton?
Thank you. So do you use the regular courts to go through and get a guardian if one's needed? Or?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. That's what used to happen is the district courts would essentially lobby to have the veterans placed under our guardianship. And when that became overused, if you will, the federal VA kind of started to pick up more of a fiduciary specific role, and the state just no longer really needed to provide that service.
Madam Chair.
Oh. Yes, Senator Eaton, a follow-up.
Thank you. So if someone has a veteran in their family who is incapacitated and needs a guardian, what do they do now?
Madam Chair and Senator.
Yes, Mr. McKinney. Go ahead.
You can go.
Okay. Again, the federal VA provides the same service. And so to my knowledge, if there's a fiduciary a responsibility for a veteran, the VA would provide that service.
Okay.
Senator Hall.
I'd like to move Senate File 1455.
Any questions? If not, Senator Hall moves Senate File 1455. We recommend it to pass and send to the floor. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Yeah,
thank you, Senator Halls. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Motion is adopted. Miller.
I think we're now ready for Senator Miller.
Yep.
We have the correct language in front of us.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're ready now.
Madam Chair and members, this bill, basically what it does is allows Houston County by resolution to provide 3-year terms for members appointed to the Houston County Economic Development Authority. This resolution should also provide a transition schedule and shall provide for staggered terms. Houston County approached me with this idea because they are having a difficult time getting citizens to commit to a 6-year term. That's why they've asked us to allow them specifically by resolution to provide 3-year terms for their citizens, for their EDA. And then I also included a letter from the Houston County Auditor, a letter in support for this legislation.
The senator, do you have any questions for the senator? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Hall moves that House File 417 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. I believe we have Senator Metzen. I don't know if he's here.
Do you want to go back to Stump for Marty? They're both here.
Senator Marty's working on something he needs to bring to us.
Oh.
Senator Pappas. Senator Murray, are you ready?
I'm told we might be able to do that amendment orally.
Okay. But if it is not that complicated.
Maybe here by the time we're done.
Senator Marty had an issue that he thought it was in there, but
and Madam Chair,
just did not have the amendment for him, but he can do it orally. Senator
Madam
Marty.
Chair, first of all, Senate File 1430 is the DNR policy bill, and we won't go through all the provisions. I know I think it's here for a couple rulemaking things, so you won't hear the testimony from Forrest Bowe of the Department Division of Forestry, who was going to testify on the Forrest Bowe account, which we heard in my committee, but we do have a couple of them. We do have an A7 amendment that I believe is in your packets. And Mr. Bob Meyer from Department of Natural Resources can speak to this. It does have a rulemaking provision in it. This was a bill of Senator Saxhoggs that passed out of my committee, and I believe it was sent here as well, but the desire was to fold it into this bill. And it has, the A7 amendment has written order that would be exempt from rulemaking provisions on line 15 and 16 of the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Yes, welcome.
Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The bill that is in Senate File 1430 that we'd like to put into the DNR policy bill streamlines the process that the department has for issuing park permits to veterans and active military personnel, and actually we're adding their families now. So the reason why this language is in front of you today is on lines 1.15 to 1.16, where we would shall establish what constitutes a qualifying military identification by written order published in the state register. The written order is exempt from the rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14, and Section 14.386 does not apply. So what we'll do is we'll work with the Department of Military Affairs and Veterans, making sure that we have the adequate description of military IDs that we will use and just publish that in the state register, rather than going through the Chapter 14 rulemaking process. The department uses this language on similar type decisions that need to be made formally, that need to be formalized, but that the Chapter 14 rulemaking process doesn't really apply to because of some of the timelines and the cost of going through that process to make some of these what are basically administrative decisions that are very simple to do. So we're looking at doing that there, and that's the reason why this section would be in front of your committee today.
Senator, is your oral amendment to this A7 amendment, or is it
no,
a different place?
No, it's to the underlying bill.
So we can adopt this particular amendment when the members are ready. Members, do you have a question about the amendment?
No, I would move the amendment.
So Senator Johnson moves the A7 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. So the amendment is in. And Senator Marty, if you could walk us to Section 51 and 52 where this particular bill has language that is under the jurisdiction of, that's the only provisions, those are the only provisions that we have to review. If you wish the staff
Mr.
or Mr.
Meyer go through that, okay. And then we'll talk about the other section.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Meyer.
Members, I believe we should probably discuss Section 21 as well.
Okay.
Maybe we could start there. That is where the oral amendment that, well, we're hoping for a written amendment, but supposedly on it should be on its way. But that's where it's similar language that we just discussed. And what this provision does, it allows the department in areas of construction zones or construction areas involving bridges and things like that in public waters. We're asking for the authority to adopt by written order temporary water surface controls to protect construction workers. If you think of the St. Croix Bridge as a big project, or the Highway 52 construction down here, if a boat goes by at full speed or making a wake, that wave can cause that barge to go back and forth, where if you have a big boom up doing some heavy work, we want to make sure that there's no safety issues involved. So this language gives us the ability to establish these temporary orders, but rather than go again through the, I don't want to say cumbersome, it just takes a long time to do Chapter 14 full-blown rules when this is very specific. We're asking for that temporary controls adopted under this subdivision to be exempt from the rulemaking requirements of Chapter 14, and 14.386 does not apply. And just on that section, this is language that you see a lot, and it comes from former Senator and Commissioner Jean Merriam. As my first year in the department, we went through every DNR section and made sure whether there was a decision that needed to be made, it was either done by rulemaking or it was exempt by rulemaking. So we make sure that when we have these decisions, we're clarifying either getting rulemaking authority or making sure that these decisions are made by written order published in the State Register and things of that nature. So this is, Madam Chair, where we did have a oral amendment that we were working on, or maybe that's it's not the amendment there. But the oral amendment would deal with concerns that we've been working with the contractors on, making sure that these are done with their consultation.
And, Madam Chair, I can read the oral amendment, if so. Would be on the bill, page 8, line 29, after commissioner insert, and it's a phrase, insert, after consulting with the governmental units and contractors, I'll read it fast and slow. After consulting with the governmental units and contractors involved in a construction project, comma. And then on the next line, on line 8.30, would insert after the word surface use controls, insert for recreational uses. That would be the amendment, and I can read that slower, and I'll also give a copy of this to Senate Counsel.
That would be great.
Wait, I'll read it again. It's on line 8.29, after commissioner, insert, comma, after consulting with the governmental units and contractors involved in a construction project, comma. And then on line 8.30, after controls, insert for recreational uses.
Members, are you following? Any questions on this oral amendment? Senator Hall moves the oral amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, on that, I believe the contractors had concerns. They haven't formally approved it, but they were saying they feel comfortable that they know we're trying to address the concern, and I think they feel this is probably accomplishes that goal. But they are here. They are here and would be happy to speak to it, if so.
Thank you. Senator, we were kind of wondering with counsel about the word temporary. Our assumption is that temporary is connected to the duration of the construction and maintenance of the project. So that's it's connected to that. We are reading it that way. So in that context, temporary is defined within that.
Madam Chair, that's the intent.
Period. Okay. Because it's not clear right now, but we hope that that is the case. Okay,
Madam
if you
Chair,
could continue,
just,
please.
So Section 51 and 52 relate to provisions within the actual bill. You can see Section 51 allows us to use the basically good cause exemption under rulemaking to change the word 5 and insert 30 into this authority that we have to provide temporary surface controls in situation of local emergency. The situation at hand was last spring we had a ton of many inches of rain, and that caused a lot of water bodies to rise significantly, and we have the authority right now to issue a 5-day no wake zone, basically is what it would be on these water bodies with the local units of government. We actually want to be able to extend that to 30 days. So this would just, there's language in the bill that changes that in statute, and the good cause rulemaking exemption just allows us to conform rule with statutory changes. That's the provision here. And it's the same provision in Chapter 52 where we're recodifying federal terms that have changed regarding flotation devices. So the bill allows that and changes that in statute, and you can see the language here that's in the bill. Actually would, for example, on 28.3, it would delete the term type 1, 2, 3, or 4 and insert wearable. So this whole language, all we're doing is asking for statutory authority to amend our rules as per the law changes within the bill. So these policy items were discussed in Senator Marty's committee. There was no concern about them. The one is to work with local agency government on these no-wake zones. The other one is, as I said, to conform current rule to federal changes on life jackets that I believe you may not have seen the letters, but the National Marine Manufacturers Association has sent a letter to the author supporting this change.
Members, you know, the language is 28.23. We have the rules part on 28.1, 28.2. Do you have any questions, any clarifications, any comments? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1430 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor.
Madam Chair, I believe this may have to go to Finance. I'm not sure if they request it or not. You can send it to the floor and they'll catch it if not.
They might have, they have not requested your bill, Senator, so as far as we can tell. You know, the jurisdiction over our part may not have any
Madam Chair,
financial.
Maybe we send it to the floor, and if they want to catch it, they can catch it. I don't think there was any cost items, but I think there may have been some accounting things we thought they might need. But if they're not requesting it, I'm not looking for another
No one
stop.
Has requested your bill, Senator. So, again, Senator Eaton renews her motion that Senate File 1430 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the floor. All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members of the committee.
All right. I believe we have Senator Metzen here. Senator, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You have Senate File 989.
For the first time I've been here before you, and it's a pleasure.
Yes, thank
you. Well, we'll see if it's a pleasure. But
we'll treat you well, sir.
Yes, I'm sure. Senate File 988 supports and sets up a central accommodation fund. The fund is recommended as the best practices for hiring more people with disabilities. And the private sector and the business community, a lot of them do it this way, including IAM, Microsoft, SunTrust, the federal government, state of Massachusetts, University of Minnesota, and others. And with that brief intro, I'll have the folks that brought this to me kind of go a little further with the explanation of the bill. But we have Beth Fraser here and Eric Nuker with me. And I'll let them, with your backing, have them make a few remarks. And we have the deaf and the deaf-blind and hard-of-hearing Minnesotans supporting this, of course. And with that, we have I'll let Beth visit with us a little bit with your committee.
Absolutely. Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Commission of Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard-of-Hearing Minnesotans. And Mr. Nuker is actually going to start the testimony.
Welcome to our committee.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Eric Nuker, and I'm deaf. I recently graduated from the University of Minnesota with a graduate degree in soil science, and my experience at the university was pretty, a great experience because I was able to access classroom and co-curricular activities with supportive interpreters or captioning other accommodation. They were met because the university had a central source of funding. So let's just say they were my department with the sole had the sole responsibility for those accommodations. It would have been a little bit more challenging for those needs to be met. But because this funding for the whole university is set up, the system pretty streamlined and pretty smooth for anybody with disabilities. I'm currently now a policy and outreach intern for the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard-of-Hearing Minnesotans. And due to the nature that of our work and the people that we work with, we also have accommodation funding set aside for the commission, so I'm able to perform my tasks and job duties to the full extent possible. But with my science background, I'm a scientist, and I'm trying to get into the science field, let's just say, you know, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture or the DNR or the Pollution Control Agency, let's just say they have two candidates that are equally qualified, you know, a person that's disabled and a person that is not, you know, they might subconsciously decide, you know, if they look at the two applications, they might decide, well, there might be additional expenses with hiring a person with disabilities, such as myself. So they might, you know, subconsciously decide to pass on that person and give it to the person without disabilities. So that's why I'm asking you guys to support the centralized accommodations funding for people with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, if I could just add on to that again,
yes,
Beth Fraser.
Sure, yes.
Thank you. So as Senator Metzen and Mr. Nooker explained, this is a best practice for hiring more people with disabilities. And as the state faces a worker shortage in coming years, we're going to need to be sure that the state is engaging as many people as possible and will need to tap into the pool of people, workers with disabilities who want to work and can work for the state but just need accommodations. The state is required to provide the accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And accommodations could be a software program or a certain piece of equipment, or in the case of somebody with hearing loss, captioning or an interpreter. Right now, the way the state works is that each department has to pay for accommodations out of its own budget. And if a budget is particularly stretched or an agency is particularly small, they may not have the funds. And as Mr. Nooker was explaining, there could be some at least unconscious bias against hiring with someone with disabilities. And so the best practice from the private sector says take the funding out of the department. Instead, set up a central fund so that hiring managers know the funding is there if they hire someone with disabilities. Then they don't need to worry about the impact on their own individual budget. The other thing they've seen happen in places that have adopted centralized funds is that people who could have used accommodations may have been afraid to ask for them or knew that their department couldn't afford them. And so people, once they know the funds are there, come forward and ask for a screen reader or large size print or an interpreter, for example. And then they're able to be more effective in their job, more efficient, and to age in their job. And so this is a best practice we're encouraging the state to adopt, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, is this going to cost the state more money?
Chairman, I think, Senator Hall, I think we have a $500,000 appropriation for this bill. Some of us don't think that's a big price to pay to help these folks get in the mainstream and get a job. And to answer your question, there is an appropriation. We'll have to go from this committee and try to get some money to do this. But we need a central place for the folks to light on and go to. So,
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, each of the departments, I assume, had a line item for an amount that they were to be spending on it. Yeah. Why haven't you just taken the line item and put it into that centralized fund instead of adding more
we've
funds?
We thought of that, Senator Hall, but Metzen. We want to make sure that this gets done. And I think if at the end of the day we had to raid is the wrong word, but probably go to every department and take some of their money, we would probably do that to get to accomplish what we want to get to here. This is very important stuff.
Yeah,
and,
I understand.
We will look at that, but I think you're talking about policy today here, and going forward, I think we'll look at all angles, but that's a good point you bring up, but the job isn't getting done well enough today without this legislation. But we'll be open-minded, but I do like the concept of what we're trying to do here, and but yes, we'll look at that too.
Senator, you have an amendment,
the
A1 amendment, and we would like to move the amendment, and there are a few corrections that the staff needs to make for the language.
Well, there are corrections because I didn't draw it up. No, I don't know. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment. And before that, I think we're going to make the amendments. Ms. James, if you could help us correct what these amendments have.
Madam Chair and members, there are just four instances of the word fund in the amendment, the A1, that should be changed to account. So on line 1.8 of the A1 amendment, delete fund and insert account. On line 1.15, delete fund and insert account. Line 1.16, delete fund and insert account. And line 18, delete fund and insert account.
There's also some technical corrections to the A1 amendment. And Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment with the oral amendments. All of those in favor signify by saying
aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Members, do you have any questions on the bill for Senator Metzen or the testifier? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Metzen. This is a great bill, and I met with the advocates. Makes a lot of sense. Just one question on the one line 1.19 with regard to administration costs. May use up to 7.5% of the biennial appropriation. I guess it might be splitting hairs given the fact that it's sort of all administration costs in a sense, but that is a little bit high. And I was just wondering if there's a special consideration that we should understand 7.5% for administrative costs is seems high compared to other programs.
First of all, Senator Peterson, thanks for your support to this measure, and I'll ask my witnesses that I thought of that too, and it appears to be just a little stiff, but is this pretty uncommon or?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, 7.5 actually seemed a little low, and so the amendment you just approved doubled it to 15.
Let's go back to the 7.5.
Senator Metzen was just going to point out that, in fact, it is 15. Senator Peterson, we just adopted an amendment that moves that to 15.
amend your question.
Just speak to that, I guess.
I'd be kind of curious here.
Ms. Fraser, if you could please tell us about, number one, why this has to be incorporated into the law and why you felt that 7.5 was even too low. So there is a reason you think it is 15. Could you expand on that?
Madam Chair and members, this is establishing a new fund, and it's being established so that it would be a reimbursement program. And so basically the Department of Administration would need to, you know, process reimbursement requests as they come in. They have the Department of Management and Budget has done a report on central accommodation funds based upon legislation passed last year. They do recommend that the state adopt a central fund, but said that they thought it would take approximately one full-time equivalent employee to administer the fund, to report back to the legislature as required by the amendment. And so 15% of a $500,000 appropriation is about $75,000, which is, one FTE, including benefits. So, I mean, as time goes forward, if a full FTE is not required, that, of course, could be reduced.
Ms. Fraser, so there is a need for a full-time person to administer $500,000.
Madam Chair and members, that was the recommendation in the MMB report on the fund.
Seems opportunistic to me.
Hey, Madam Chair, I think these are good questions. And I guess we move on to finance, and maybe we can fine-tune this as we go through the process. But in the meantime, the policy is very good policy.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I agree that finance should take a very close look at that. But in the meantime, I'd move that Senate File 989 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Senator. And we need to make sure you and I are in the committee just to make sure we work with your testifiers to kind of figure out what are some of the what are the exact tasks, you know, that will be included in managing a new account that require a full-time person. I think that is important, and we need to figure it out.
Madam Chair, I think that's a good suggestion. I promise to work closely with you and others to kind of fine-tune that as we move forward.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
If you could also take a look at what you're doing. If the departments have a line item and you're designating $500,000, then all the departments are basically, if their amounts equal $500,000, they're getting a raise in every department then.
Right.
And if that's what you want to do, I think you can certainly do that, but you need to look at that.
Right. Very definitely. Very definitely. Any other questions, members? If not, Senator Pappas renews her motion that Senate File 989 be recommended to pass,
as
amended, and report to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator
very much,
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas. Senator, you have Senate File 1176.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1176 establishes a grant program for the state to reimburse local units of government for salary and benefits paid to public safety employees who are members of the National Guard, a Guard militia, or any reserve component of the military or Navy who take leave to fulfill their duties to the National Guard or reserve component. Members, the Minnesota Veterans Preference Act gives members of the military, both active and honorably discharged, preferences in hiring for government jobs. As a result, many firefighters, paramedics, and police officers employed by local governments are also members of the Armed Forces and the Minnesota National Guard. Military service requires these employees to be away from duty while training or deployed. Local government units that employ military members are required to provide time off with pay to accommodate military service up to 15 days per year. Because of the need to properly staff for public safety, the need to replace military members can lead to decreases in staffing levels for fire and police departments. In order to compensate for staffing shortages, fire and police departments must often backfill for the absent military member via the use of overtime. The increased cost can be a huge strain on already tight city budgets. The St. Paul Fire Department, for example, spent $480,000 backfilling for military members in 2011 and $390,000 in 2012. The same year, Minneapolis spent $300,000 and Duluth spent $100,000. But fire departments all over the state have been impacted. If the employee is not replaced, often cities must operate fire companies with staffing below national standards or take fire companies out of service for the entire day. In any case, the local taxpayer is greatly affected. There is no question that current and former members of the military make outstanding firefighters, paramedics, police, and police officers and deserve our continued appreciation for their service to us through the Minnesota Veterans Preference Act. However, this well-intended state law, augmented last year to give veterans increased preference, has come with a price that for years has been borne solely by local governments and property taxpayers. So we're asking that the legislature correct this unfunded mandate effective this law by helping out with this grant program, which wouldn't completely reimburse local units of government, but would help them somewhat. And I have with me Mr. Chris Parsons, president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and also to my right is a firefighter service member, Matthew
Banier.
And I'd like you to listen to them for a few minutes.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Welcome to our committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and my group represents 1,600 professional firefighters, paramedics, EMTs throughout the state of Minnesota in 40 different communities. The fire service employs many current and former members of our nation's armed forces. In fact, many of the traditions of the modern fire service, from our rank structure all the way down to our blue uniforms, can claim their roots from many of the soldiers who returned to civilian life after our country's Civil War. Our state's fire departments are a natural fit for our citizen soldiers, and they have, by and large, proven time and time again to be assets to their respective communities. Add this to the fact that Minnesota provides military veterans preference in hiring for government jobs, and it's no wonder that the fire service employs a disproportionate amount of former and current soldiers. As Senator Pappas stated, this bill sets up a grant program to allow local government units that employ servicemen and women in public safety roles to recoup a portion of the costs incurred when these men and women must miss work in order to complete their military service, up to 15 days per year. Minnesota statute requires public employers to provide paid time off in these cases. Minnesota has been a leader in supporting its members of the armed forces, especially in the area of expanding employment rights. In my 15 years in the fire service, however, I've witnessed how the paid time off provision can have a negative impact in the area of public safety. My employer, for example, the St. Paul Fire Department, employs roughly 30 firefighters that are also members of the armed forces. It's not uncommon to have around 10% of our department off on military leave when long-term deployments intersect with training weekends. In order to maintain our current minimum staffing number of 114 personnel on per day, the department must replace our citizen soldiers with costly overtime, which can including salary and benefits for a 24-hour shift, can exceed over $1,000 per day per replacement. In 2014, the St. Paul Fire Department covered 602 shifts with overtime due to military leave. This, of course, is not just a St. Paul issue. It is a statewide. It's statewide and proportional depending on the community size. Minneapolis spends around a similar amount of money on military leave. In fact, Minneapolis, 22 out of their last 24 hires, firefighter hires, have been military veterans. They've done a great job of supporting our men and women in the armed forces. Duluth spends about $100,000 per year on military leave. Rochester spends about $20,000 just on salary, not including overtime costs. St. Cloud also spends about $20,000 per year. In 2014, the Minneapolis Airport Fire Department spent about $250,000 for their 45-person department on costs associated with military leave. The other side of this coin is what happens when budgets shrink and belts tighten, as they did during our most recent recession. In St. Paul, as in other cities across the state, the answer often was to operate fire companies below national minimum staffing standards or shut them down completely for the day, which meant a reduction in service to our communities. Understaffing is also a danger to firefighters and has been proven to be a significant factor in firefighter fatalities and injuries. Therefore, in order to relieve some of the strain on fire department budgets who employ service members, I ask the committee to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Parsons? Please, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Manier. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 1176. For the last 5 years, I've served the citizens and visitors to the City of St. Paul as a firefighter EMT. I'm currently assigned to Engine and Paramedic Company No. 9 on the Upper East Side of the city. I'm also currently serving as a Master Sergeant in the U.S. Air Force Reserve 934th Aeromedical Evacuation Squadron, and have been for nearly the last 12 years. I've twice been deployed overseas, first in 2007 to Qatar and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and the second time in 12 to Ramstein Air Base in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. During my service, I flew 14 combat missions while evacuating 205 sick and injured members of the U.S. and coalition forces. I'm a strong supporter of veterans' preference. The skills I and other members of our armed forces learn in the military are often well-suited for the rigors of firefighting and the paramilitary structure of the fire department. I am thankful that the state of Minnesota decided to honor the sacrifice of veterans via legislation that supports our employment rights. As I continue serving both my country and the people of St. Paul, I am at times required to miss scheduled work days in order to complete the obligations of military service. When this occurs, the department must usually call in overtime to maintain its current 114 personnel on per day minimum staffing. My fire department there are approximately 30 firefighters who also serve in the military and are often gone with military obligations overlap, meaning multiple positions must be filled often at the cost of overtime. At times, such as the most recent recession, replacing our department's service members has not been an option due to the lack of available funds. The fire department would forgo overtime replacement in favor of short staffing a fire company or reducing the amount of fire companies in the city for the day. Each option decreases safety for both firefighters and the public by increasing response times and reducing the amount of firefighters available for a given call. I strongly urge the committee to support SF 1176, which will in turn better enable my department and those around the state who have active servicemen and women in their ranks to better protect the safety of the citizens in their community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marin. Thank you for your service. Senator Scalzi, you have a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm wondering, thank you for this good presentation, and I know we need to have full staffing when for these important jobs. I'm kind of wondering, from your comments, I sense that maybe they're not the ones in charge are not in adding staff, or are they limiting the overtime? So then maybe they're not staffed to full capacity, and if so, what in this bill would require them, as long as they're going to get the reimbursement, that they would have the full staffing available?
Mr. Parsons or Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, there currently is no mandated minimum staffing number. NFPA states, that's the National Fire Protection Association, they state that good practice is four person on a fire company. Most departments in the state do not operate that way. They operate with three or less. In St. Paul, we operate with four. We have kind of a different staffing system. We also do the paramedic transport service. And we've been somewhat insulated from some of the lesser or some of the worst impacts of the last recession. So there's nothing in the bill that mandates that cities have to maintain their current complement of fire companies or have a minimum number of staffing on a fire company.
And Chair.
Senator
Bubbs. And Chair, Senator Scalzi, it's a reimbursement program, so the city would have already had to pay for the overtime, and they would apply for a grant from the Adjutant General to be reimbursed for things for expenses they've already expended.
Senator Scalzi.
And that makes sense. So we would keep the staffing levels adequate, and then there's no mechanism here for how they do it, but I'm assuming then that there would be paperwork changes to say that they actually did pay for the staff rather than just add it to the budget. I'm
yes, Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, I actually misspoke a minute ago. Mr. Parsons corrected me. The reimbursement is for the salary that they're paying for the firefighter who is in the military while he's gone. So it's a partial reimbursement. It's really based on the available funds and how many people apply. But it definitely is based on how much you've paid out for that individual that is not able to provide the service in the city because they're providing the service internationally.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, do you know if the private sector has the same authority if somebody's in the military and they go 2 weeks to training or whatever, that they have to pay them? That they would have to pay them their salary too?
Mr. Parsons can address that.
Okay. Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, the private sector and the public sector are treated differently under veterans preference. They're not required to give preference to veterans in hiring, and also they're not required to pay a veteran's salary when a veteran misses work, scheduled work for training.
Senator Pepa, so this particular funding is just to pay that salary, but it's not to hire somebody to do the job while the person is gone, right? It doesn't cover both. It's just one. Mr. Parsons.
I can answer that, Madam Chair. The reimbursement could be used and probably will be used to help offset the replacement costs for that firefighter that's gone.
Madam Chair, and I think it doesn't specify whether they hire someone temporarily or whether they have overtime, pay for overtime. Madam Chair, I forgot I have an A1 amendment.
Yes, you do.
I thought we moved you. We didn't.
Thank you for remembering that.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Do you have it in your packets? All of those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Anything else, Senator Pappas, we would like to cover?
Madam Chair, I
just closing remarks.
I would move that Senate File 1176 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Next in the agenda, we have Senator Dahl, Senate File 1439.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 1439 basically adds about 8 words to existing law. So Senate File 1439 does, it amends the definition of energy efficient projects in the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, which is probably why it's in front of your committee, to include water meters that increase efficiency or accuracy. This means that a municipality may use these water meters in a guaranteed energy savings contract. And judging by how much water gets used in my house, I wish I had some water metering going on to save a little bit more energy. I do have Jim Girard, Johnson Controls, to answer any questions, but I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. You know, I was curious about why do they need permission? Why do you need permission to put any devices that are more efficient?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Girard. I'm with Cook Girard Associates and representing Johnson Controls. You need permission to do an energy savings contract, which means the income that would be generated from the water meters, and the savings that would come with more efficient collection of the data would be used to pay back a loan or a bond that the city would use for the upfront costs.
And Madam Chair,
Senator,
and currently the existing methods that they're able to do that are listed, but to watering metering is not. So I think they have to stick pretty close to the statute in terms of what is allowed and what is not.
Interesting. Members, do you have any questions? Any comments? Again, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, I move then that Senate File 1439 be recommended to pass and probably refer to the floor.
Energy and Environment, Senator.
Energy and Environment. I'd be glad to go there. Energy and Environment.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Chair.
And next in the agenda, we have Senator Johnson. Senate File 348. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I've got Senator Heaton and I have both Senate File number 417 in our packets for Senator Dahl.
Yeah, I do too.
That's the wrong file. It was supposed to be a House file.
Okay.
417.
No.
Oh.
That was numbers House file.
Throw that one out.
So throw that away. Yeah, that was the confusion we had with Senator Miller.
You've gone by that.
Sorry about that.
this was the correct number for Senator. Yeah, and Senator Miller, we also correct. Yeah, we have moved the correct numbers for both Senator Miller and Senator Dahl, Senator Anderson, which has had a little mixed up with the printing of the incorrect number, incorrect language for Senator Miller, but I think everything has been corrected. Senator Johnson, you have Senate File 348. You could please proceed.
I would wish and hope that this goes as simply as the rest of the bills that we've heard. I rather doubt it, but you never know. We have worked very hard in between these two hearings, but Madam Chair, do we have to bring that back to the table or anything like that?
Not necessarily, Senator. I think you've worked on some of the issues, so we'll just hear it again and hear what you've done since.
You have in your packet.
I believe you have an amendment. So
an amendment that I would like to have adopted, and I would be asked that I could explain it.
Ms. James,
the A7 amendment.
Ms. James will help us clarify what we're going to do right now.
Madam Chair and members, the last time the bill was under consideration, the committee adopted the A2. It's not in your packets at the moment, but I have copies that we'll hand out now. We made an oral amendment to it, but it will be neither here nor there because there's also the A7, which is what Senator Johnson would like the committee to consider today, so we're passing that out too.
And that's a delete all.
Thank you, Ms. James. So we just wanted to make sure that you know, people have all of the documentation, what you did before in the A2. And the A7 is already in your packet, so you don't need an extra copy.
Which one are we?
So Senator Johnson is moving the A7 amendment, which is a delete all amendment, and she will be presenting the A7 amendment. So Senator Johnson moves the A7 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator?
Members, I'd like to begin by talking about the amendment that we have are presenting here today. I want to try to clarify to you the many changes that we have made since this bill came forward. We had our first amendment that was a major change from the original bill. And then we've gone on and listened to people. We've talked to as many stakeholders. I've spoken to everyone that has asked to discuss this issue with me and others. I have with me Catherine Mullen from the Minnesota Catholic Conference, who is working on this issue with us. First of all, in Section 1 of the A7 Amendment, you will see that we added on a commissioner from the Department of Human Services or their designee, the commissioner from the Department of Health or their designee, and a family court referee appointed by the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. So three new members that were brought on, and it changes significantly the original commission that was made up of 12 members of the legislature. With the three new members of the commission will no longer be an even number, so there's highly likely to be a majority decision, much more possible than a stalemate with maybe six people one side and six the other side. That was a request that was made by a number of the issues, especially the stakeholders that wanted changes. Especially on that one, we worked with Outfront Minnesota on that. In subdivision 3 of A7, the ranking majority member of the commission who is appointed to the Senate by the Senate majority leader shall convene the first meeting. That is a change from the original or the A2 amendment that said the Senate Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee on Rules and Administration shall convene the first meeting. Regarding Subdivision 5, the Conflict of Interest section, we pared it down and made it clear that we would ask any commission member not participate in or vote on a decision of the commission in which the member has a direct or indirect personal financial interest, and a witness at the public meeting of the commission must disclose any financial conflict of interest. That briefly makes it more concise and not as cumbersome, I think, as what was put in the A2 amendment. The duties, if you have copies of both amendments, A2 and A7, you'll see that we have really tried to take out the ethical, or not the, the value statements and some of the, again, some of the topics for study. We brought them down into what I would believe to be a much more understandable and concise reflection of what we would hope to study in this commission. I'll call attention to number 8 on the A7 amendment, page 2, on line 9. Line 10. We instead of saying the surrogate mother, we just said the surrogate. And that was, again, a discussion with some of the stakeholders and people that were interested. The reporting section is, again, saying that we may not, we are likely, hopefully, we will be having a majority report, but that there can be more than one report submitted. I think that really concludes really the changes. Were there any other ones?
Yes.
Oh, yes. And in the reporting section, subdivision 7, in A2, line 19, the commission must submit a report including its recommendations and draft legislation to implement its recommendations, so forth. We have put in the word may before the word draft in that subdivision. So it may draft legislation. I would guess that we will be deciding whether there's any legislation that we would want to draft and present to the chairs and ranking members of the legislative committees. So with that, members, I hope it clarifies what we're doing with this commission. We've worked very hard. We're not limiting the topics that are could be included. I've come across a couple of questions that have been asked to me by persons who are interested in this bill, and you know, one was from an insurance person who asked me something like, "Does the employer of the surrogate need to give her maternity leave? What if a surrogate negligently injures a baby? Is she liable? Would it be considered a business transaction by insurance company? If so, how would that affect homeowners insurance policy?" These are examples of things that this commission, I would hope, can address and come to some agreement on what we might and should do. So I guess with that, I have two people that are here with me. Ms. Baker, Mary Baker, who is was a surrogate, and I would like her to tell her story to you.
Okay. Madam Chair,
welcome
and members
to the committee.
Of the committee, thank you. My name is Mary Baker. I am here to speak in support of Senate File 348. I believe that studying and looking back at some of the potential effects on, for me, especially the children, to have come into this world in this method, I think is very, very important. My circumstance was basically because my sister, who was living in Arizona at the time, and I in Minnesota, her children are tragically killed in a car accident, and that left her and her husband without children. And I, knowing my sister and her husband, knew them to be fantastic parents, beautiful people. And were unable to carry a child. My sister had had a partial hysterectomy. And another factor for them was that their age was getting to be 40s. And you're not a great candidate for adoption either when you're in that age group. In their grieving process, I moved forward to ask them if I could assist them because I knew that how it worked, that they could have their own child with me being what is called a gestational carrier, not a surrogate, but a gestational carrier because it's not my child at all. It was very clear to me that this would be my niece or nephew, and a lot of factors were necessary to contemplate before making this decision. My husband and I had to imagine how our children would be affected as well. My carrying a pregnancy in my late 30s would make my young children uncomfortable, especially self-conscious, knowing that it's not even their sibling. And so we had to imagine how they would feel, how they'd be impacted. Would they be embarrassed, ridiculed, whatnot? And our public appearance, how people would look at it. Knowing that you're doing this because of love, for love, and yet people will judge regardless of your intentions. And my concerns were with insurance as well. Was it legal for me to carry a child at my job under our company insurance policy? There wasn't a lot of information. This was 12 years ago. 15 years ago, the children were killed. 12 years ago, I was able to carry a child with a healthy pregnancy to full term. His name is Maximus, and they reside in Arizona today. He's a healthy, happy little boy. I am grateful that I was given this opportunity to be in this position, to be able to carry a child for my sister. But I very much am concerned for those that give up biological children through surrogacy, even though they are doing it maybe through love. I would hope that they would fully understand the impact on that child and maybe themselves and maybe their children in their future, knowing that their parent had given up a sibling in a way. I still see it that way, that is what is happening. And there's no doubt in my mind that there will be complications with that. Part of the process I wanted to explain, too, was as fully vested in my emotional commitment to doing this for my sister, there were only 3 hospitals in Minnesota at the time that would even perform this. They would not consider my sister at 2 of the hospitals. The only hospital that considered her at her age of 40 was Abbott Northwest, and they weren't looking to get the perfect scores for the reason of, you know, having good results. This was definitely not a good result opportunity for them. There was less than 10% chance of this pregnancy holding, not due to my body, but due to the age of her egg. So a lot went into this. We went to the hospital figuring that we could just walk in the door and have the opportunity to have this procedure. And they stopped us there, and they had us go through quite a gamut of psychological tests, interviews, and they had a lawyer signed up for my sister and her husband to protect them from potential problems that could arise. Let's say I wanted to keep the child. Anything. They didn't care that we were siblings. So what happened was very necessary and important and educational for us. But once the baby's born, they're done. The lawyers are done. The psychologists are done. Now we walk out the door, and no one checks up to make sure that everything's okay. So I would like you to consider this Senate File 348 to protect those and the things that they might not be aware of that could happen potentially down the road.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Baker. Yes, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Baker, I'm very much in favor of this bill, but I have a somewhat of a personal question. Did you, in your situation, have motherly feelings or desires to keep the child? Or in your mind, if I could ask this question, I know it's kind of personal.
Nope, that's a very good question.
In your mind, were you all set that this was your sister's child, and you were just a wonderful gift for them to be able to carry that child?
Yes.
How did that go?
Yes, absolutely.
By the way, I have 8 children, so that's why I think about these things.
Yeah. Well, I'm a child with 8 siblings, so, and I can tell you that I probably wouldn't have done it for 7 of them, but definitely for them. yes, definitely it was always known to me in my heart and in my mind that it was my sister's child.
Sure.
It was a beautiful experience for all of us involved, very tearful and joyful. And, and I'm going to see him this weekend. No, he's very special to me, and I think I am to him as well. He knows, and he understands, as a 12-year-old, as much as they can understand. But, yes.
Very neat.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Senator Johnson, do you have any other testifiers you wish to?
Madam Chair, I was not privy to the testimony that Ms. Baker would be bringing to this bill, but I knew she supported the bill. And that is one thing that I will say about nearly all of the people that I spoke to and that have heard about this issue from me or from someone else. Nearly all of them have said that this is something that needs to be discussed before we go ahead and put something into place. And it's been, 2002, so, 13 years ago that this started here in Minnesota. And we haven't accomplished very much for anyone. And let me tell you that I am not opposed to surrogacy. I am interested in protecting the child, the mother or carrier, whoever it might be, and the intended parents, because all three of those groups have had at some time or another incidents that have been negative for them in terms of the intended parents that often we don't think about, that sometimes the person who commits to carrying the baby changes their mind in the middle of the stream, and that would be devastating, I would guess, to people who were counting on that and watching that happen. So I'm just saying, members, I will do my best to keep this very fair, and that would deal with the issues of all of the parties that are involved. Because I think there needs to be some sort of law put into place that would help to keep this a topic that has some, if you want to call it regulation or oversight, I guess is a better word for it. So,
thank you, Senator.
With that, I would have with me, I said before, Catherine Mullen from the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and I have, from the Catholic Conference, I have Catherine saying that they are not interested in banning surrogacy. And if you would speak to that, Catherine, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair,
Welcome
members
the committee.
Of the committee, just to clarify, so the Minnesota Catholic Conference, we are really supporting...
Could you please introduce yourself just for the tape?
Catherine Mullen, excuse me. Just to clarify, we are supporting this bill because we absolutely feel that it's important to study surrogacy and the issues associated with it. There is obviously a lot of different positions that one can come down on when it comes to surrogacy and different ideas that a lot of people have on surrogacy itself. We personally at the Catholic Conference feel that there are some major issues with the commercial aspect of surrogacy, and we've been very open and upfront with this We feel that the commercial aspect is something that needs to be studied and are open to airing these discussions within the context of a fair commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator, I understand there are several people who want to testify. I do have two people, Julie Berman and Dr. Lisa Erickson, in my agenda, but I don't know if anybody else wishes to testify. If you could please approach the table. Go ahead and introduce yourself and whomever wants to testify first and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Julie Berman, and I am here representing Resolve, the National Infertility Association. And I do have some handouts if somebody wanted to
staff
distribute them.
Please go ahead.
Okay. So I'm a Minnesota resident, and I also serve on the board of directors of Resolve, the National Infertility Association. We are a national nonprofit whose mission is to improve the lives of women and men living with infertility. Infertility is a common disease. It affects 1 in 8 families. Resolve works on legislation in all 50 states and with the U.S. Congress, and we do oppose this bill. We are opposed to creating a commission because Resolve provides support and information on all family-building options. And when someone turns to gestational carrier surrogacy to become a parent, it's typically the last resort. And let me explain how the process works. This is a process whereby each party, the intended parents and the gestational carrier, have separate legal counsel. And the process I'm going to explain is very similar to what Ms. Baker shared. Each party undergoes mental health evaluation, and the carrier must be able to pass a strict medical evaluation. At any point in the process, the carrier or the intended parents can decide not to move forward. Likewise, any professional involved in the process can do the same, and can often happen as a result of mental health evaluation, or perhaps the physician determines it's not a good idea to move forward. Medical guidelines and legal and mental health best practices are already in place to dictate gestational carrier agreements, as you heard Ms. Baker describe. Women who choose to be gestational carriers for another couple, the intended parents, are treated under those medical guidelines to ensure they are well informed about their choice. Resolve is very happy and willing to work with the Minnesota legislature on a comprehensive bill regulating gestational carrier surrogacy in Minnesota. In fact, we have supported past legislation in the state that would have helped the courts better determine parentage in these types of arrangements, and we support SF 1704. In addition, in the past 3 years, we have supported legislation that passed into law in Nevada, New Hampshire, and Delaware, laws that codify the best practice of the medical, legal, and mental health field and include protection for gestational carriers so that no one can be exploited. Similar legislation is pending in Maryland, New York, and the District of Columbia. Right now, that kind of statute does not exist in Minnesota, but we know what is needed. We urge the legislature to turn to the professionals in your own state, doctors, lawyers, psychologists, along with advocacy groups, to get behind legislation that's right for Minnesotans. We do not need a legislative commission to spend time and resources studying surrogacy. What we need is smart, well-crafted legislation that protects all parties involved. We are also opposed to creating this commission because we think it's important for you to know that we believe the intent behind the bill is not transparent. I've met with Senator Johnson, and I know she deeply, deeply cares about people and really wants to protect people from being exploited. But I want to make sure you know that two of the supporters of this legislation are not from Minnesota and travel state to state supporting this kind of anti-family legislation. They aren't here to speak for Minnesotans. Their goal is very simple: outlaw gestational carrier surrogacy in the U.S. So this bill is not about patient safety or helping women who choose to be gestational carriers or to think about the resulting children. It's about setting up a process to outlaw these family-building options so that a law can be introduced next year or the year after. We have seen these same supporters in other states do just that. Thankfully, their efforts have been unsuccessful. And this is fact. Take a look at their websites, follow their work, and you'll reach the same conclusion. Lastly, I do want to point out a factual error that was made by the Minnesota Catholic Conference representative on Friday in the House. Resolve deals in facts, so I feel it's important to make sure you know the facts. It was stated that we at Resolve have a financial interest in people doing gestational carrier surrogacy or IVF, and that is just not the case. Our board does not have any representatives from pharmaceutical manufacturers. We have an independent board. I serve as a patient advocate, and we adhere to the strict standards of excellence from the National Health Council. See for yourself, all of our annual reports and financial statements are on our website, along with all of our board members. We are completely transparent and have nothing to hide. And we receive no financial remuneration from anyone doing IVF or gestational carrier surrogacy whatsoever. So I sit here before you representing the 110,000 Minnesotans with infertility. Show the infertility community that you care. Show them that you are about smart and transparent legislation. If the outcome of the study does what its supporters intend it to do, every woman without a uterus and every woman with medical issues preventing a pregnancy and every gay man in Minnesota who wants a genetic link to his or her child will not have the option to do so. We want gestational carrier surrogacy to continue to be a process where everyone is thoroughly informed of their options and no one is exploited. Please work with us before the next session to move forward on legislation like 1704 and like statutes from other states that provide the protections we all want and need. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also have a statement from a gestational carrier who couldn't be here today, and she asked me to read it. Is it over?
It is a brief statement.
It's a brief statement.
Appreciate it.
Yes. So this is from Callie Colkind, who lives in Princeton, Minnesota. According to the supporters of this bill, she is an uneducated, low-income subclass breeder. She wants me to tell you who she really is. Her name is Callie. She's the mother of four beautiful children, born and raised in Minnesota, and chose to raise her children here. She's also a gestational carrier. She had the privilege of carrying twins for another couple. The intended parent was born without a uterus, but they were able to use the intended parent's eggs and the sperm to make perfect embryos. She went to 38 weeks and delivered two healthy baby boys. She had a very thorough process, including her and her partner passing criminal and financial background checks, medical records approved by IVF doctor, OBGYN approval, several examinations by licensed mental health professionals, extensive screenings with agency social workers, and medical screenings at an IVF clinic. She feels the bill makes strong presumptions while lacking factual information. She is a gestational carrier. She was educated. She researched the choices she was making. And she is not economically disadvantaged. She's not psychologically damaged, and she was not and has never been coerced, intimidated, or forced into making any decisions she wasn't comfortable with. She had 24-hour access to a social worker, journey coordinator, and legal representation independent from her intended parents. She's opposed to the bill because she went through the process and knows how detailed it actually is. She does not feel there's a need for a committee built of legislators to form opinions regarding surrogacy without including anyone that's part of the process. No one would know more than the people who do this on a day-to-day basis. Her greatest gift is the birth of her four children. She began the journey wanting to give that experience to somebody else, but she gained a lot more. She was given the greatest gift of all. She was entrusted with twins for 8 months and able to give them back to their parents healthy and happy. Please remember her and her story as you say no to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We have two questions, and then we're going to get to Ms. Erickson. Senator Hall and Senator Peterson.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier,
yes.
I need to take a little issue.
Okay.
With what you had to say, because it made it sound like as legislators we could not make smart legislation. We were not going to be transparent. We were not including professionals. We're not here to help women, and all those facts, and those are all wrong from my point of view.
Thank you.
And so, and according to supporters, I'm a supporter of this legislation, and I think what these women have done have been wonderful things. And so it's a little hard for me to hear you tell me that I'm not doing the smart legislation, that can't be done by legislators. We want to take in all aspects of the professionals and hear from all of them and do this right and do a really good job and take our time at it. I would just disagree. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
I passed.
Thank you. Dr. Erickson, if you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Lisa Erickson, and I am a board-certified obstetrician, gynecologist, and a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist and infertility subspecialist practicing in Minneapolis. I am at the Center for Reproductive Medicine that helped Mrs. Baker with her project. Congratulations. I am a member of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I am a member of the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technologies, called SART, and I am a member of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. I represent myself as a fertility expert with 27 years of frontline experience in this field of medicine. Doctors train with 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency, and 3 years of fellowship. On top of that, we have two written and two oral examinations and annual recertifications. Do you remember this childhood verse? First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes a baby in a baby carriage. Mm-hmm. How far we've come from that. But what if during delivery, the doctor encounters massive, unstoppable bleeding and has to do a hysterectomy on a 26-year-old patient? What if a medical condition poses a life-threatening situation and pregnancy is contraindicated? Not that many people choose to build their family through gestational carriers. It's mostly not by choice. It can be far, far from choice. On the other hand, can you imagine a situation where intended parents come to you with a desire to build their family because they want a child with their whole heart and soul? Can you imagine a situation where every child is a wanted child? Because this is the fundamental idea behind the use of a gestational carrier. Gestational carriers offer the incredibly generous act of agreeing to carry a pregnancy for another couple for whom carrying a pregnancy is impossible. Reasons why I and the ASRM are opposed to Senate File 348 is that in its original form, where it came from, the bill attacked IVF, donor egg, donor sperm, along with gestational surrogacy. And while the bill was amended and much of the offensive language was removed, the supporters of the bill want to ban gestational carriers in Minnesota, and they do not like the technology of IVF either. In fact, the language still includes the following tasks for the Legislative Commission to study. Subdivision 6, number 3, refers to the business practices of the fertility industry, including attorneys, brokers, and clinics. The term fertility industry, used to describe a Nobel Prize-winning field of medicine, is a wee bit offensive. Subdivision 6, Section 8, that was recently changed. The word mother was removed from surrogate. The important thing about that is the terms surrogate mother is not appropriate because the surrogate is not the mother in these arrangements. The gestational carrier is not a parent in these agreements, nor is her spouse or partner. The gestational carrier is a proper definition, and we must be careful with the terminology. Please see the handout called Consideration of the Gestational Carrier, a committee opinion from the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Women who choose to be gestational carriers are treated by these professional guidelines, and they ensure that they are well informed about their choice. In addition, these women, as you heard from Mrs. Baker, undergo rigorous psychological, medical, and legal evaluation, as do the intended parents. I believe that proper regulation can protect all parties involved and provide guidance to the courts on the intended parentage. This is what we're all in agreement with. It is important that the intent of the parties to a gestational carrier agreement be formalized in a written legal document produced by qualified attorneys specializing in third-party agreements. You didn't have to think about this before 1978. The world of IVF changed with that first test tube baby. It is important to provide safeguards for all the parties involved in collaborative reproduction, including not only any children born of such agreements, but also the intended parents, donors, and gestational carriers who are part of such agreements. It is important to make clear the requirements, obligations, and rights of all parties in the collaborative reproductive agreement. The state of Minnesota has an opportunity to create a legal structure for regulating gestational carrier agreements, which incorporates the rights and duties of all the parties involved in such agreements. That legal structure should reference the medical professional guidelines established by our organizations. Please look at the bill introduced by Senator Pappas, Senate File 1704, which addresses all of these concerns and is supported by the ASRM. Conclusion. A commission to study the business practices of a field of medicine which is already regulated by federal and state laws and governed by professional guidelines is not the right approach. It appears evident that the ultimate goal of Senate File 348 is not to set up a process for establishing good public policies for the citizens of our state, but rather to mask an ultimate ban of this form of family building under the guise of a study that appears biased from its inception. I am opposed to this commission as it is outlined because I feel it needs, because I know of a better option, which is Senator Pappas' Bill 1704. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Erickson. I don't know if there is anybody in the audience who wishes to testify, but we have two questions for you, Senator Peterson, and then Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I didn't get the testifier's name with the jacket on the end, the most recent testifier.
Dr. My name is Dr. Lisa Erickson.
So I'm going to, Dr. Erickson, try to stick to the merits of the proposal that's in front of us, which we've strayed from considerably in the testimony that was just given. You had cited a couple of lines, objections, particularly Clause 3 on line 2.1, and a couple others. But I take it from your testimony that even if those things were modified or that language was modified, that it wouldn't really change your position with regard to the underlying bill. Is that safe to assume? And correct me if I'm wrong.
Dr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, Senators, I believe that the original proposers of the bill had an ultimate goal, which was not welcome in my medical community. And I'm uncertain that the commission can maintain that unbiased view, not including medical stakeholders, legal stakeholders, and educated parties in this field. It's a complicated medical field that has taken us years to learn how to do it right.
And we have the experts at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, and I encourage that we tap into that expertise and use them to our full potential.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think that gets to the point. I mean, I'm as a member of the committee, and we've obviously spent a great deal of time on this issue. I'm interested in substantive conversation around the proposal that's in front of us. Mm-hmm. But what constituted the majority of the testimony that was just given was innuendo, expressing concern about underlying intentions, speaking to great length about things that are not included in the proposal that we have before us. Now, I would suspect that both parties have very well-formed opinions about the ultimate place that they want to get to, and I won't spend my time as a member of this committee suggesting to you what your ultimate goal is here. And frankly, it's I don't take offense to very many things. I think the taking of offense is oftentimes the first refuge of a poor argument, frankly. But the suggestions that I, as someone who has spent a great deal of time, and you may not know a whole lot about me, that I have some ultimate agenda in this process is ridiculous on its face. I think, you had referenced a lot of consensus or the opinions or expertise of the medical community, and I don't suppose to be an expert in your field. I cede that to you. But what I would suggest to you is that there are some things, especially in the arena of public policy, that go beyond that simple sort of estimation, that we have constituents and many, many, many interests that go beyond maybe the realm or the profession in which you operate on a daily basis. The fact of the matter is that the proposal that's before us is a commission. If you object to some of the language, that's fine, but I would suggest that your testimony was just as skewed as the people that you sort of castigated in your commentary, that and frankly wasn't terribly productive in getting the committee to a place where we can have a conversation around the merits of the actual language that's before us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senators, I hope that, the individuals who come to testify before us clearly have some opinions as to where they think we need to go. And we can hear, and we often hear, obviously, different opinions. My hope is that we take, what we hear and then make our own conclusions at the end is our decision. But we appreciate that you're here. Obviously, some of us agree and some of us completely disagree, and we will, make that known with our vote. But I think it's important that we welcome the people that come to support the efforts or not. So Senator Dahl, Senator Pappa, Senator Johnson.
Thompson.
And I don't know if Senator Anderson had his hand up. No, sorry. So just Senator Thompson. So Senator Dahl, Senator Pappas, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank all the testifiers that were here today. And I probably agree with where you're coming from for the most part. Matter of fact, I thought the first bill that came in here was not a very good bill. I don't think that was a good bill at all. And so I'm going to defer to the author of this bill on this one. I think that she has worked quite a bit on this particular language. I'm also going to probably vote for, I know I'm going to vote for Senator Pappas's bill as well. So ultimately, I hope that the report that comes out of this is something then we can substantively debate in terms of the merits and whether this whether surrogacy needs more legislation or not. So, again, well, I thank you for your testimony, but I'm going to probably support the bill and the work that Senator Johnson has done on this.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree that I think Senator Johnson has done, has worked very hard. I know she cares very much about this issue. I did have some suggestions for maybe some improvements in the language and wanted to know what the Senator Johnson committee thinks about this. And that is on page 2, line 1, to change the sentence to be more, again, more neutral, to say the appropriate roles of attorneys, let's add counselors in there, brokers, and clinics. Because these are people who are getting paid to do a job. And, you know, we don't usually negatively convey they're you know, getting paid to be a lawyer to represent someone's rights. It's just kind of a neutral position. It's more of a neutral position. So that one, if we could, Ms. James could maybe look at that language. And then the other one on 2.4, again, I wasn't crazy about the potential exploitation word, but if we could say considerations related to the legal protections of women in surrogacy arrangements. So we all agree that women need to be protected. They're not, we don't have to assume they're going to be exploited. So maybe Ms. James could help me with those two amendments and move that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, thank you. I see no problem with the changing the language on clause 3, and we can work. There would be no opposition to me. On consideration or in clause 5, the reason I took up this topic was because of my concern of the potential exploitation of women. And so I hate to give that up. That is the reason I chose this, to take on this issue. This is not personal to me, and the things that have been said about me have been very difficult for me to listen to and not respond. But I want to say to Callie Kolkind, who I haven't ever met, I have never thought of her as an uneducated, low-income subclass breeder, and I am the author of this bill. I am working with the Catholic Conference and the Family Council. There is no hiding of that. I'm not ashamed of it. But it's not their bill. It's my bill. And so when you talk about people that you say that I am that way, that's what I've heard this morning and today, and my heart is pumping, and not because I'm nervous, but because I'm really, you know, I don't like it when people assume that they can say about me what they think all they want, but they don't have to say she is not being transparent. They can say, I think she's being not transparent, but they can't tell me because I am transparent. I have said it from the beginning. I'm not opposed to surrogacy. We have it in my family. But, you know, I will stand back because I don't want to harm the possibility that we can get something done in this area. And I think with the legislature, I was very, very adamant that I wanted a legislative commission. Now, I may be wrong, but that's what I wanted to have, because the reason is, and I think I've said it before, that we are looking for something to put into law. You can listen to all kinds of people that will tell you that they want this and this and this and this, but if it doesn't get can't get passed into law, it's really not helping anyone. So with, as I started out with 12 members, equal members, saying, okay, we have to find equal from the Republican and the Democrat majorities and minorities. But anyway, that's what I'm concerned about. I wanted something to get into law. We had a task force in 2002. They came back with the report that said they didn't support any recommendations. There hasn't been anything that's put into law, as far as I'm aware of, regarding this topic. So let's do something different, is what I have.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. So we have an amendment that was presented by Senator Pappas that it had two portions. The first one you accepted, the second one you didn't.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
I have
Pappas.
A proposal to alter my second amendment in an interest of compromising with Senator Johnson. Also, we have an expression on the floor of the Senate about we don't impugn the motives of other senators. And I think that is a good thing to remind everyone in the room that, you know, I mean, I think we need to take this at Senator Johnson at her word that she is trying to resolve a difficult problem in our society. And I certainly respect you for that. So, Senator Johnson, on line 2.4, what about if we said considerations related to the potential exploitation and legal protections for women in surrogacy arrangements?
Sure.
So we've got kind of both ideas.
I would accept that.
Then if Ms. James wants to respond.
So, Ms. James, could you read the two?
Madam Chair and members, I'm not positive I got the first one, but I think it is this. On page 2, line 1, delete everything before attorneys and insert the appropriate role of
attorneys. I added counselors.
Counselors. And
brokers
then,
and clinics.
Okay. So I'll say that again. Page 2, line 1, delete everything before attorneys and insert the appropriate role of, and after attorneys, insert counsels, comma.
Counselors.
Counselors. Counselors, comma. And then on page 2, line 4, after exploitation, insert and legal protections.
So should that be of or for?
Madam Chair.
Of women or for?
Exploitation and legal protection is fine. Any questions on that amendment? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, what's your reason for not studying the fertility industry? I would think we'd want their input. We'd want to hear what their best practices. At least the doctors that I've talked to, they've got real expertise on this.
Then, Madam Chair, I just don't like the word fertility industry. I think it's insulting. I think if we found another word for it, we could include that in there. And maybe Dr. Erickson could advise us for an appropriate word.
Senator Johnson.
Dr. Erickson suggested that we could, rather than call it fertility industry, the roles of the field of
reproductive medicine.
Reproductive medicine.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So it would be appropriate. Could you read
Page 2, line 1, delete everything before attorneys and insert the appropriate roles of the field of reproductive medicine, comma, including attorneys, comma, counselors, brokers, and clinics. Well, I didn't read that as a proper amendment, though. Is that what you're trying to get to?
I think maybe practices fits there, then. The practices of reproductive medicine.
Yeah.
And the appropriate roles of attorneys, counselors, brokers, and clinics.
Mm-hmm. Did we get that?
Should I say it again?
Yeah, please.
The practices of reproductive medicine, including the appropriate role of attorneys, counselors, brokers, and clinics.
So I would say on page 2, line 1, delete everything after the 3 and insert the practice of reproductive medicine and the appropriate roles of attorneys, counselors, brokers, and
clinics.
And then
clinics.
We just leave that. It's already there. And then the rest of the amendment is on page 2, line 4, inserting and legal protections after exploitation.
Okay, any questions on that amendment?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Johnson?
I just didn't hear the last line.
Point four.
You counselors, did you include counselors and clinics in that, Ms. James?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, clinics stay in the sentence. So all of those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
Amendment is adopted. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't let it pass without mentioning the fact that Senator Johnson's intent has been called into question. I think people would know that I disagree with Senator Johnson on a lot of policy, and that's the way that this place is supposed to work. I've never seen anything from Senator Johnson to indicate that she is anything other than sincere, and though we may disagree on other things, we happen to agree on this bill. I think it is unfortunate that people come in here and make the kinds of comments about a member that they have made about her with no justification, no evidence to support that kind of thing. And I, as Senator Pappas, the President of the Senate, pointed out, if I were to make that kind of comment about Senator Johnson on the floor, I would be admonished, and if I went real far, could potentially face an ethics complaint. And so that's unfortunate. I also like to comment on Dr. Erickson's testimony. Nobody in this room, I don't think, has more respect for the medical profession than I do. But what I seem to take from her testimony, and I want to give Dr. Erickson the courtesy to respond if I misunderstood, is that it's almost a standard of, well, if medicine can get us there, if science can get us there, then it shouldn't be constrained by people who don't have technical knowledge. History is loaded with examples of the application of science devoid of moral philosophy taking us down very bad roads. And so with all due respect to Dr. Erickson, and again, I do respect your profession and the people who have the intelligence and the drive to achieve what you've achieved, my hat is off to you, but science should not be the determining factor of what is morally right or wrong. That is for a different area of expertise, just like I'm a lawyer. But lawyers, but you don't apply legal analysis to determine right and wrong. And the same is true of science.
Thank you, Senators. Senator Johnson, I have a thought. I've been thinking about the language on page 213. There is almost an implication that there is a request in there of information being provided. And I'm wondering if you will be open to delete that particular provision in there. It's almost like there is a directive. It says information to be provided to the child. I know that this is one of those kind of delicate issues. There are some people, some parents who choose to do this. They do the arrangement and they do tell their children, you know, when they are adopted or whatever, and others really don't. But it seems to me that in here there is almost the way the language is written is that we're kind of already saying the information to be provided to the about, you know, of the surrogate and the child's biological, and you also call gestational parents as well, which is something that, you know, I think the people were saying, you know, they are not parents, you know, they are carriers. So I'm wondering if you're open just to deleting that particular sentence and just leave it open to the commission just to determine. I'm pretty sure that that's an issue, obviously, that is going to be, they're going to talk about this, but I don't want to give them the directive that they must provide that is whatever is that information. So I'll feel more comfortable if that sentence is not there.
Madam Chair and members, I appreciate your suggestion. This is a topic that's been listed to discuss. It doesn't say anything. It would, in my mind, it would be to say should or should not there be information provided to a child born of a surrogate. And
Madam Chair,
I think, Madam Chair, that as you know, surrogacy is somewhat new, and we are now seeing children that are born of surrogacy because of surrogacy that may have some issues, much like adopted children often want to know their background, because if they have a medical history or something like that, that they might want to know that.
No, I completely understand that. I think it's just the way the language is written. It's almost like information to be. It's almost a directive that this has to. Dr. Erickson, if you could briefly.
Madam Chair,
I think
Senator,
I know you're dying to say something, so I'm going to let you.
Following the philosophy of first you know harm, our medical society recommends complete transparency. We don't recommend that families have secrets. And so this type of reporting seems to be a normal consequence of something that should be studied and considered. But we already have position statements on that from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.
Thank you. Senator Peterson and then Senator Pappas. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think Dr. Erickson covered it. I just wanted to point out that the language going back to the original line 128 is just simply saying this is an item to be considered amongst the items to be considered, not that anybody has to get information or not get information. I could see if you read line 2.13 in isolation how you could see that as a mandate, but it's simply listing it as an item to be considered for the commission.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to suggest then an amendment on 2.13, unless the Chair was going to move to delete it. Another approach would be perhaps before information to say appropriate, because it's just not information, but what's appropriate, and depending on the child's age, it can be different levels of appropriate information. And then on line 2.14, after biological, I would insert parents. And before gestational, I would put the. And at the end of the line, I would delete parents and insert carrier.
Thank you.
So the line would read, appropriate information to be provided to a child born of a surrogate about the child's biological parents and the gestational carrier.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson?
I think they're acceptable. I have the question that, again, would some people are offended by the word carrier, that it implies something that's, you know, kind of like a, I don't know, it's not like a human being doing a loving act for someone or that sort of. But, again, that's what I don't, for myself, I don't have any, I'm okay with it. Either way.
Madam Chair, I think we're not really being very consistent in how we're using gestational carrier and how we're using surrogate. So an alternative, we just don't want to use the word parent. So an alternative would be to say then at the end of the line, and the surrogate.
I would prefer that, if that suits you, Senator Pappas.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is appropriate, Senator Johnson, because I think that question of, you know, it kind of presents some legal questions as to who is the parent when you say parent. Mm-hmm. So we do have to be clear.
Madam Chair, we're also using interchangeably the word biological and the word intended. So I think perhaps the study, if this bill passes, would look at also definitions of words, mm-hmm. that when you're going to call people intended, mm-hmm. are you going to call them biological, or call them carriers, or call them surrogates?
But the intended parent might not be biological.
Okay, so on that amendment, I think it's clear, right, Senator Johnson?
Yes, it's clear to me.
All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Senators. Senator Hayden?
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Johnson, thank you for at least having this conversation with us. I know that I told you I have some concerns about kind of where we're going, but I thought that it would be appropriate, at least in this committee, to get you kind of to your next stop, which I think is judiciary, and then you can have a legal conversation about this with the members of the Judiciary Committee. I do want to say, though, around the table, and especially to those who are supportive of this, those advocates that are there, I think that you've learned the lesson today that we have to be very careful in the language that we use. We have to be very careful about whatever your conversations are in your own world, whatever that it is dangerous to bring those accusations into this body, because then we get caught in the intentions of the members one way or the other, in your intentions, as opposed for us as lawmakers, not as scientists or lawyers, but as lawmakers to try to get this information objectively and make decisions that are going to be good for the public. So as you continue to move this bill, I would try to figure out how to take some of that out of your testimony, and I would also ask for you guys to get in a room so that there is some level of consistency even in the language that we use. If not, then you put Senator Johnson and the rest of us in a very tough position in trying to make good public policy for the state of Minnesota or the citizens of the state. So I just wanted to say that I think that that was important as I sat here and really listened carefully to this argument. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that, again, I think Senator Johnson has worked very hard on this issue, and I do think it needs more discussion. I've asked Senator Sharon to do an informational meeting after the deadline to, on this as well, so to have more committees in the legislature that have an opportunity to have the discussion. Perhaps in Judiciary you'll have a discussion as well, and then if it passes there in the Rules Committee, I think that's going to be very helpful in the long term. The bill that was referenced that I introduced, there's no intention to have a hearing on that bill. It was just to let people know that there is a regulatory structure out there that we can look at and comment on in future sessions. And then I also want you to tell you that my no vote today is in no way to indicate, other than what I said, my appreciation for your hard work. It's just that when it finally comes down to it, I just don't think a legislative commission is the way to go. I don't think that it's something that legislators are, it's very practical to have legislators do this over the interim. I think it needs to be discussed more, but I don't think a legislative commission is the way to go. That's the only thing.
Thank you.
That's what we're here to decide.
And yeah. Senator Johnson, an issue that also it concerns me somewhat is that all along the way there has been a tremendous amount of conversation in both houses about the need to address kind of the integrity of what you're trying to do. And it is my understanding that we have not had enough movement in the House to incorporate some of your ideas and your desire to really keep the integrity so that people are clear that you really want an honest, transparent conversation about the issue itself, that you do not have any other agenda, that you're not against surrogacy. Some of that movement, you did a tremendous amount of work here, and I am very appreciative of that. I do not believe that has happened anyplace else. And so I am concerned about that, and I am hoping that that the intent is not that the authors will just conference this in behind closed doors without input from the public, because I don't think that's a good process. So I want to voice those concerns because I want that on the record, that I do appreciate immensely your time and your desire to bring everybody to your office and go around and talk about this. And this particular amendment is a reflection of that, of your intent to really bring those voices together. Yet, you know, we need both houses to move in the same direction. So I just want to make sure that that's on the record. I believe that this committee has not been requested by Health and Human Services, but it will go to Judiciary. So I don't know where the health part that Senator Pappas mentioned will be actually vetted, because I don't think this bill has gone to HHS. It's not been requested by HHS here. The House has not requested in HHS. Either they just send it to finance, and there is not, as to my knowledge, any financial there is not a financial cost to this. But it has to be addressed, and I don't know if it will be from Judiciary, it will be sent to finance to address the cost associated with this bill.
Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson.
Just to let you and the committee know, the House adopted the A2 amendment, the one that we have changed. We have modified or changed it from the, but so now the A2 amendment, as far as I know, is the same as this amendment. So it is on the way to
okay.
where we are.
Okay. So I was not aware of that.
if you could briefly make your statement.
I just want to make a very, very deep apology. My comments were not meant to indicate that anybody supporting this bill has bad intentions. I know that, and I appreciate being able to be part of democracy and meeting with Senator Johnson. I know her intentions are good. I probably should have used the words initial opponents to just let you know what I was trying to say about where this bill maybe came from in the beginning. But my deep apologies. I know I can hear from you that I caused offense.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Senator Peterson, anyone else who wishes to testify, who need to provide a statement? Any other questions, any other comments? Senator Johnson, if you could move your motion, it'll go to Judiciary.
I would move that Senate File 348, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary Committee.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much, members, for all the work that everyone has done.
Thank you, Senators. And Wednesday we are going to have our last hearing in this committee. We have a few bills that we're going to hear, so I hope that please you come on time. We're going to do our best to empty the room and start right away. Bills are mostly, I think, not controversial with the exception of one or two. Hopefully it will not take too long. But this will be done in Wednesday, and thank you so much for all of your attention. And for now, we will adjourn. Thank you.